You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
It is my honor to introduce our next keynote speaker, Dr. Emily Chamley Wright. Dr. Emily Chamley Wright is the president and CEO of the Institute for Humane Studies, a nonprofit dedicated to advancing human flourishing by developing the ideas that underlie a free society and the people who carry those ideas forward. Prior to her tenure at IHS, she served as a provost and dean at Washington College and as the Ilbert H. Niess Professor of Economics and Associate Dean at Beloit College. An accomplished scholar in the field of culture and economics, Dr. Chamley Wright has authored or edited 6 books, including The Cultural and Political Economy of Recovery, Liberal Learning and the Art of Self-Governance, and Culture and Enterprise with the late Don Lavoie. Her work explores the challenges facing contemporary liberal democracy, emphasizing the norms and institutions essential to the liberal project. She embodies and advances the ideas that ground the Markets and Society Conference, that the most challenging and pressing problems require scholars that cross and talk to multiple disciplines, use multiple methods, and is fundamentally a co-production effort. I am proud to be included in her academic lineage, and I'm thrilled that you get to hear and learn from her today. Emily, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you all. It is such an honor to be here with you all, and a genuine pleasure. Now, my motivation for this afternoon's talk is that liberalism has given humanity the most reliable foundation yet discovered for peace, freedom, and widely shared prosperity. And we are in real danger of losing that foundation. Over the last 10 months, we've seen an executive decree attempting to end birthright citizenship, expansive use of emergency powers bypassing constitutional constraints, threats of military force against longstanding allies, the weaponization of the Department of Justice, the militarization of American cities, masked and unidentified ICE agents raiding homes, businesses, and civic spaces, summary execution of suspected drug traffickers, the deportation of people lawfully within our borders to foreign prisons, and a self-inflicted wound of an unprovoked trade war. I could, of course, go on. In addition to these overt threats of the liberal order is the great forgetting, when the principles that sustain a free society become so familiar that they fade from view. When these principles are in good working order, we tend not to notice their presence. When they're significantly compromised, many of our fellow citizens find themselves struggling to explain and defend, and in some cases, openly reject what once seemed self-evident. That is the danger of the present moment. Not only that our constitutional order is under direct attack from people who swore an oath to defend it, but that our civic imagination appears to be incapable of resisting that attack. The question is, how do we make visible the principles that sustain the liberal order so that we are not merely slowing the drift toward a post-liberal society, but decisively reversing its course? My concern for liberalism's future is certainly one of constitutional political economy, the formal rules, the bones of the liberal project. Yet it is also a soft tissue problem of values, norms, and habits that make the formal rules work. And unlike policy reform, once the soft tissue is degraded, there's no legislative remedy to restore the default norms that hold the whole thing together. And my remarks this afternoon are aimed at understanding that challenge and sketching a path toward liberal renewal. To meet this challenge, we need to understand how the soft tissue of liberalism works, how ideas, norms, and networks interact with one another and with the formal rules of the game to produce either resilience or decay. For that, I'll draw on a framework that Virgil Storr and I developed, work that grew out of our research on community rebound and recovery in the wake of catastrophic disaster. That project and this project draws upon the work of the late Don Lavoie and the students of the late Don Lavoie, including Virgil, Pete Becky, of course. It is in line with Deirdre McCloskey's project on the intersection of economic performance and values and virtues, the Ostrom's work on self-governance. I could go on. But the other thing that is, I think, pretty cool is I actually think that it follows along the lines of what Mark Granovetter's latest project is as he's focusing on the importance of informal norms. So I think that there's some continuity in the keynotes from today. Let's start by beginning to build a visual of what I'm talking about. The idea behind this approach is to offer a cultural economy framework that complements a political economy understanding of the world. And by starting with this visual, it's important to recognize that a cultural economy framework begins with constitutional political economy in the spirit of James Buchanan. As with political economy, cultural economy recognizes the formal institutions that govern human interaction. And by institutions, I don't mean organizations or agencies. I mean the rules of the game, such as rights of property, contract, constitutional design and guarantees, and other political and legal rules that govern our interactions with each other and with the state. And just like political economy, cultural economy aims to understand how those rules of the game drive both individual and social outcomes. Individual outcomes like health, literacy, lifespan, economic mobility, and other human development indicators, and social outcomes like patterns of economic development and social cooperation and cohesion. And both political economy and cultural economy recognizes that those outcomes in turn have influence on the institutional rules of the game. Patterns of successful economic performance, for example, tend to strengthen and reinforce legal frameworks that have us respecting one another's property, entering into and honoring contractual obligations, and so on. In turn, those strengthened institutions of property and contract further expand markets and drive even better economic performance. Additionally, though, cultural economy also focuses on the social terrain that governs human interaction beyond the market, legal, and political spheres. For example, customs of kinship can shape patterns of resource allocation, both in terms of material and non-material resources, like social status and social capital, that represent real value to those who have access to them. In other words, there's a lot going on in this space between institutional rules of the game and patterns of performance. An entrepreneur might rely on the formal institutions to gain access to financial capital, but she may also rely on socially embedded resources within informal networks of kinship, ethnicity, gender, social status, and so on. And in turn, those informal networks generate norms of reciprocity and obligation that can influence in both positive and negative ways social and economic patterns. And those patterns of performance can in turn influence the formal rules of the game. And it's this middle space of socially embedded resources that I want to unpack. Now, as Virgil and I developed the framework, we focused on four dimensions of social life that help to define the opportunities and constraints that shape strategies for purposeful behavior. These categories, shared mental models, generalized norms, cultural tools, and social networks are not exhaustive. They emerged as the most relevant factors in the puzzles that we were trying to solve at the time. Of course, we would be delighted if some in this audience were to pick up the cultural economy research program and develop further categories, categories that we surely have missed. But the upshot is this. Cultural economy research helps us to understand the connections between culturally embedded resources and patterns of social and economic performance. And for my purposes this afternoon, it also helps us to understand the inner workings of liberalism and may point the way toward a more robust liberalism going forward. So let's dive in to shared mental models first, which draws upon the insights from new institutionalist thinkers like Doug North. For the sociologists in the room, mental models are conceptually similar to what William Sewell calls ideological schemes. Shared mental models are theoretical frameworks that help us to make sense of the world. Mental models can be highly refined and well articulated, like the Pythagorean theorem. Or they may be more general, like the inherited wisdom that says patience is rewarded. In either case, there's a theory of the world at work. That theory may be operating in the front of one's mind, like the geometry student struggling to solve for the length of the hypotenuse, right? Or it might be operating in the background. Social coordination depends, of course, on formal rules underlying the liberal order. But these rules persist, they're sticky, because people hold certain theories of the world in their head. Liberalism's most basic mental model is that every one of us is endowed with dignity just by virtue of the fact that we are human beings. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Obviously, at the moment that these words were committed to parchment, we still had a lot to learn about how universally applicable this mental model was, but the contours of the model were there. There are certainly other mental models at work within a liberal society. Distributed power is safer than concentrated power. Innovation, industry, and trade make nations wealthier, not plunder. Intellectual freedom surfaces truth better than imposed consensus. Tolerated difference fosters peace more reliably than enforced conformity. The rule of law protects liberty far better than the rule of men, and so on. Again, some people will embrace these mental models as articulated arguments that have stood the test of human experience and evidence, right? Others adopt them more unconsciously as inherited wisdom. Either way, the formal rules of ordered liberty endure in part because specific mental models lend those rules an intuitive appeal of moral fairness and practical workability. And this brings us into the terrain of generalized norms, the behavioral and attitudinal defaults that guide our interactions with others. We keep our promises and we expect others to do the same. We offer small kindnesses to strangers, not because we expect that that particular person will return the favor, but because we expect that someone would do the same for us if we found ourselves in similar circumstances. Generalized norms can flow directly from explicit articulated mental models or from the fact that we're born into a context of generalized reciprocity that has us offering help to people in need. When it comes to default behaviors, most of the time we don't engage in the cost-benefit calculus. We just follow the habits of a given place and a given community. Social capital research informs this terrain and underscores that generalized norms can be a genuine resource that help to get things done, as James Coleman observed in his classic essay on the topic. Behavioral norms among Jewish merchants in the New York Diamond District, he observed, minimized fraud, lowered transaction costs, and extended the reach of a hyper-local marketplace across the globe. Though the constellation of generalized norms will vary across time and across cultures, liberal societies tend toward particular clusters of behavioral norms, norms like toleration and forbearance, cooperation over predation, fair dealing over extractive behavior. And each of these norms, we can connect the dots back to liberal rules of the game. In robust liberal societies, we refrain from engaging in predatory behavior because we expect that there will be legal consequences for doing so. But generalized norms has us going well beyond mere compliance with legal constraints. We cooperate. We engage in good faith. We look for win-win opportunities and refrain from extractive behavior because it accords with our moral intuitions. And it's not simply a matter of personal virtue, it's a social expectation, right? We expect that others will also refrain from predatory and extractive behavior. And it's this mutual expectation that renders the liberal order a cooperation game, even in commercially competitive environments. Now, there's a lot more I can say about the role that generalized norms play in a liberal society, but for my purposes this afternoon, the most relevant feature of generalized norms is their automaticity. Because they are behavioral defaults, generalized norms work fast. And if those defaults are liberal defaults, they were much more likely to engage in behavior conducive to the extended order, such as engaging in market transactions with strangers. The more accustomed we could become to relying on the productivity and promises of strangers, the more we feel at ease, comfortable, specializing in our own pursuits. Even if it means our skills in some of these other areas wane, we start to build up a level of expertise that then has us alert to opportunities for innovation, which brought in our specific spheres of expertise, and that in turn extends the breadth of the extended order even further. And when generalized norms become second nature, when a more particular behavior becomes not just something we do because it's the rule, but because it's just the right thing to do, the more likely we are to overcome temptations of transactional gamesmanship that would have us violating pro-social norms for short-term gain. And all that automaticity, all of that stickiness creates a scale effect for the institutional rules that they support. As we learn from Eleanor and Vincent Ostrom, when moral constraints have been so internalized that we follow them without thinking, external monitoring becomes less necessary, thereby lowering the cost of rule enforcement. As the costs of rule enforcement decline, the benefits of those rules expand, such as peaceful trade and less predatory behavior. Those behaviors start to become more common and widespread. So in short, liberal norms scale the impact of shared mental models, which further strengthens liberal institutions. Okay, cultural tools. This, by the way, represents the one single point of disagreement that Virgil Storer and I have ever had over our 35 years of being associated with one another. So, but it's an enduring thing. So if this part doesn't make any sense, this is all on me. Don't blame Virgil. Cultural tools represent another category of socially embedded resources. Here I'm building on the work of cultural sociologists like Ann Swidler, who draw attention to the link between cultural resources and human agency. The idea here is that we're not merely passive recipients of culture, we can also be active practitioners of culture. In Swidler's framing, this is particularly true in unsettled times, where we're more likely to take notice of and actively deploy culture in a tool-like manner, where, for example, historical narratives or collective stories of who we are as a community or as a country get noticed with fresh eyes and strategically deployed toward particular outcomes. As Michaela Novak and I argue, cultural tools have played a particularly important role in widening liberal emancipation. Consider, for example, the unsettled times of 1852 when Frederick Douglass gave his famous Independence Day speech, "What to a Slave is the 4th of July," to leading citizens in Rochester, New York. Douglass knew that what the crowd expected of him, to laud the ideals articulated in the Declaration of Independence. Instead, he spoke of the hypocrisy of celebrating American liberty while 4 million Black Americans remained in chains. Rather than celebrating the country's liberty, he called out the great sin and shame of American slavery as hideous and revolting. In his oratory, Douglass leveraged a common cultural touchstone, Independence Day celebrations, to link the abolitionist cause with what it means to be American. In his I Have a Dream speech, Martin Luther King Jr. also leveraged America's founding narratives. As he said, when the architects of our republic created our founding documents, they were, quote, signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir, a promise that all men would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. King's audience had assembled at the Lincoln Memorial to, in King's words, cash a check that will give upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. By recognizing the anger and the frustration of the crowd, this line earned hearty acclamation. King warned that a rude awakening would follow if that anger were dismissed. But within the space of just a minute or so, he moved from that anger and despair of a promise unfulfilled and values betrayed to the dream. The dream, he observed, that is deeply rooted in the American dream, the dream that our country will rise up to live out the true meaning of its founding creed, that we will hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And joined with Judeo-Christian references to universal brotherhood and the call and response cadence of the Black church, King artfully deployed the cultural tools at his disposal to issue a challenge. If we as Americans believe what we say we believe, we must join together in the struggle for civil rights, peacefully and in a spirit of brotherhood. And as he closed out his presidency, Ronald Reagan picked up the cultural tool of liberty to remind his fellow conservatives what it is that truly makes America great. Quoting from a letter he'd received, "You can go to live in France, but you cannot become a Frenchman. You can go to live in Germany, in Turkey, or in Japan, but you cannot become a German, a Turk, or Japanese. But anyone from any corner of the earth can come to live in America and become an American." Reagan continued, "Liberty is what makes ours a great and special place. It's what breathes life into the dream. It's what creates the future. And it's the bold men and women yearning for freedom and opportunity who leave everything, everything behind, who believe most deeply in the American dream." The point I want to make here is that liberal societies, especially those with collective and varied histories of who we are and why we have a special stake in a free society, have a well-stocked cultural toolkit from which to draw. The resources embedded within social networks are another important building block of a cultural economy. Think, for example, of Mark Granovetter's work on the strength of weak ties thesis. That research inspired, including the strength of strong ties thesis. Social networks can be a source of material support for childcare, for elder care, a social safety net. It can also provide pathways toward social and economic mobility. Along with generalized norms of trust and reciprocity, social networks form the fabric of a civil society that gets things done. The art of association is practiced not by isolated individuals, but by and within neighborhoods, congregations, sports clubs, activist coalitions, volunteer organizations, arts communities, and so on. As we learn from Tocqueville and Dick Cornell and Eleanor Ostrom and so many scholars in this very room, civil society is a cornerstone of a liberal order because it is an arena where problems get solved beyond the orchestrating hand of the state and alongside commercial motivations of the marketplace. Now, zooming back out, I want to draw attention to something I've already hinted at, and that's the interaction effects across these categories, as suggested by the double-headed arrows. A mental model of universal human dignity will shape generalized norms that favor respect and equal treatment, not just in our politics and legal framework, but also in our social interactions. In turn, those norms, if practiced regularly, will tend to broaden circles of trust, expanding who we include within our social networks. And that expanded view of who counts as us will have us interacting with people who come from different places and hold different beliefs and so on. And those experiences can, in turn, strengthen the mental models of universal human dignity in a virtuous reinforcing cycle. Another example, a narrative of resilience, say a historical memory of survival through war or persecution, may get picked up and used as a cultural tool within a particular community facing some overwhelming challenge, like rebuilding in the aftermath of a catastrophic disaster. If such efforts succeed, right, that experience may strengthen a mental model that has us saying, you know what, challenging times can be overcome if we just pull together. And that mental model can in turn strengthen norms of association, which for that very community, those norms of association will lend resilience to that community the next time they face a new challenge. Now, it's really important to acknowledge that these are, I say all of this in idealized terms. There's nothing that guarantees that it will work out exactly this way. But that said, as Virgil and I found in our research on post-disaster recovery, these virtuous cycles of mutual reinforcement can directly drive successful social outcomes like faster and more robust post-disaster recovery. Unfortunately, though, not all cycles are virtuous. The interaction effects can also feed vicious ones. When high-influence political and cultural leaders violate norms brazenly and with relentless frequency, when they flood the zone with excrement, as they say, they can shift the Overton window of what's considered in bounds within the public sphere. Incivility and intolerance become the new default norms. These degraded norms harden the boundaries of our social networks into tribalist factions. That tribalism, in turn, promotes illiberal narratives of who we are, blood and soil notions of who counts as us. Those hardened identities amplify mental models that has us blaming them for everything that's wrong with the world, further degrading liberal norms of civility and toleration. On top of these exogenously imposed vicious cycles, there's also the endogenous one, the great forgetting that I described at the outset. When a liberal society becomes so accustomed to the fruits of ordered liberty that it runs on autopilot, liberal mental models can become so well-worn that they fade from deliberate thought and discourse. When that happens, democratic norms respecting the rule of law, press freedoms, an independent judiciary, and so on, can too easily wane because we've lost the capacity to recognize threats and to effectively defend the liberal order against those threats. It's under these conditions that authoritarian norms become, well, normalized. We're more likely to lean on cultural narratives of power and dominance as the principal pathway to solve problems of public concern, further eroding liberal mental models that emphasize persuasion and liberty over coercion. Again, I'll emphasize that there are very real upsides to the autopilot effect of liberal defaults. It's not the police car on the corner or the cold calculus of cost and benefit that leads most people to cooperate rather than predate. It is the internalized norm, it's the internalized sensibility that removes predatory behavior from the menu of options in the first place. Yet the auto responses that lend scale and resilience to liberal institutions can also be the seeds of complacency. When we forget that those behavioral defaults were hard won through human history and require continued vigilance, we risk losing them not necessarily through overt rejection, but because we assume they will always be there, even if we fail to deploy them consistently. And when crisis hits, the public is left without a clear, well-specified mental model from which to resist illiberal drift. And here I want to be clear. This is not a partisan problem. It's a human problem. Even if the nationalist right does not prevail in upcoming midterm and nationalist elections, for example, if authoritarian impulses are still normalized, liberalism will lose. Arguably, the current threats are pulling us out of the great forgetting. But as we've seen so frequently, when liberal arguments come out of the mouths of those who have violated those principles when it suited them to do so, they lack the credibility needed to be taken seriously. My point is not to engage in a game of who's to blame. I suppose there's a good case to be made on either side of the conventional political divide. But I want to say this with emphasis, that is not the point. There are myriad and complex reasons why we are here. The question is, now what do we do about it? In a moment when we seem to be spiraling into a vicious cycle of decay, how do we begin to reverse the spin? Some of the work lies squarely in the realm of political economy, reforms to restore the balance of powers, to close gaping holes in emergency authority, to assert the constitutional checks designed to prevent the centralization of power and control. And that work requires liberal arguments based on reason and evidence. Now, clearly, evidence-based reasoning is not going to change the minds of autocrats, but it can shift mental models of thought leaders and people positioned to drive reform. And so many in this room are already doing that work with the appropriate sense of urgency. And for that, I thank you. In addition to the argument and evidence that can shift mental models, we should also be alert to other leverage points within the cultural economy ecosystem, strategic opportunities for turning vicious cycles into virtuous ones. And by we, I mean liberal intellectuals, scholars, intellectual entrepreneurs, civil society leaders. As bad as things are, these unsettled times do offer us an opportunity to deploy liberal cultural tools, our symbols, our stories, our founding ideals, not reluctantly, not defensively, but with conviction and with skill. In contexts where intellectual sophistication matters, we so often refrain from flexing these tools. A full-throated affirmation of constitutional principles can have us sounding naive, like you just walked out of a 10th grade civics class. and especially in academic audiences. Praising the founding is construed as being blind to its egregious inconsistencies. But we need to be bold nonetheless, right? While liberal principles can be grasped by any reasonably capable 10th grader, the principles don't apply themselves. The world continues to offer up fresh challenges, and liberal solutions are not always obvious. Every generation has to figure out how to apply liberal principles to the wicked problems they face. And to those who say that the liberal project was tainted right from the start, we need to persuasively remind that the value proposition of liberalism is not that it shows up on the scene fully formed. The value prop of liberalism is that it has an inbuilt capacity for self-correction, including self-correction that leads to emancipatory progress. So I submit as a modest proposal that we reclaim the stories that inspire, stories of emancipation, of dissent, of pluralism protected under law. This is not an appeal for a marketing campaign. It is an appeal that liberal intellectuals in this room play a role, an essential role, that most of our fellow citizens cannot fill. By deploying the cultural tools of liberal society, our distinctive contribution is to shine a light on the inner workings of liberal life that otherwise tend to be hidden from view. People of ideas have the power to reveal how respect for the dignity of all people, civility, trust, even among strangers, reciprocity, and yes, a degree of reverence for democratic norms, the things we so often take for granted, are fundamental. Rather than mere ornaments, liberal norms, cultural touchstones, and theories of the world are the sinew that allow the bones of the liberal order to work as a resilient system. And I'll close with one further thought. At a moment when so much hangs in the balance, we may doubt whether our work really matters. When we see liberal norms torn down one after the other, it's easy to despair. Many times I've asked myself the question, once the toothpaste of liberal norms are squeezed out of the tube, how the hell are we going to get them back in? No satisfying answer has yet to come back. So I changed the metaphor. While others flood the zone with excrement, we need to flood the zone with light. The light of wisdom that comes from serious minds advancing the ideas of a free, self-governing people. In dark times, that light shines all the more brightly. Every argument that contributes to the glow matters. Every mind opened, every mind changed matters. And when the work feels lonely and exhausting and frustrating, remember to look up. Look across the table, and I literally mean to the people in this room. Lean over, catch their light, and keep working. Thank you for allowing me to share in the light and wisdom that we are creating together in this community.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.